Okay, let's begin. Hi.
Hello.
Okay. Okay. What I would like to talk about for the next 55 minutes, and I'll try to leave some room for questions at the end, is what I have here is a symbolic interpretation of the Torah, Yaakov, and Esav. Now, what I'm interested in fleshing out is I said in some other sessions that a Kabbalistic reading of the Torah assumes that stories, the narratives, resonate on different levels. And I want to illustrate that in the story of Yaakov and Esav, where we have the story of two brothers, older brother who is for some reason destined not to be selected, and the younger brother who is destined to be chosen, and what happens around that, and what that symbolizes, what that points to on a different level, a different type of reality. We also, through this exploration, we are also going to discuss ritual. What I didn't say in the previous sessions is that not only do the stories tell a story on multiple levels, but that rituals tell stories. And we're going to discuss the ritual of Yom HaKippurim, of the scapegoat, as telling a story. But let's begin with the story of Yaakov and Esav. So I have here the verses in source number 3, where Yitzchak is old and he can't see. And he says that I'm old and now I have to, the time has come for me to bless my children. And Rivka is aware that Yaakov is the one who needs to get the blessing. She knows this. How does she know it? How does she know? Where does she get the certainty from to do what she does, which is pretty terrible if you think about it? She manipulates her blind, aging husband to give the blessing to the child that he didn't intend to. And it's going to be one of the last things he does. It's the last thing we hear about him in the Torah. So she has to be pretty sure. What? Right. She has, by virtue of prophecy, that Shnei Lu Mimbi Vitnech, right? That there are two children and they're going to fight it out and that the younger one is chosen. So she has that by virtue of prophecy from which she gains the certainty to perpetrate a deception, which is very problematic. As an aside, as opposed to Sarah, where Sarah feels that Yishmael is a bad influence, she confronts Avraham. Where Rivka, for whatever reason, cannot confront Yitzchak about this. So she manipulates. She goes around it, what was in the previous panel, the Mapainik way, as opposed to the revolutionary way. So it goes back to Sefer Bereishit, the different ways of approaching things. And which way is more effective is also a question. But in any case, so what does she tell? What does she tell Yaakov to do? She says as follows. Havi Ali, the seventh verse, Pasuk Zayin, I'll read it and I'll translate it. Havi Ali Tzayit, Vaseli Mat'amim, V'ochela. Right, so the father said, bring me food and prepare it for me. And she says to Yaakov, V'ata b'nishma b'koli l'asher ani mitzava otach. Listen to what I command you to do. Lechna el hatzon, go to the flock. V'kachli misham shnei gda'i izim tovim. V'ese otam mat'amim l'avicha kasher ahev. Go, take two good goats, and I will make them up the way your father likes them. Okay? Now, the pasuk says, Shnei gda'ei izim tovim, good goats. What does good goats mean? Not moral goats, right? Tasty goats, right? Fat goats. Now, why the Midrash, we're not starting with Kabbalah, right? The Midrash picks up on this. Because the assumption is that the Torah does not inject meaningless information into a story. So why it would be enough if they told me that took two goats and the goats were used to their ultimate. The food was used to feed Yitzchak and then the skins were used to to put on Yaakov's hands to make him hairy. Why do we have to be told that they're tovim? What is good about them? Okay. So look at this midrash. And when I first came across this midrash, it baffled me for a very long time. And I hope it baffles you as well. But you're not going to have to wait as long as I had to wait until I figured it out. Lechna el hatzon, bekach li misham shnei gdaizim tovim. Source number 4. Go to the flock and take for me 2 good goats. Mahu tovim, what does it mean good? Rab Brachmi b'shem Rabbi Chelbo said, tovim lecha v'tovim lebanecha. Good for you and good for your offspring. Tovim lecha, so now good doesn't become, isn't morally good, and it doesn't mean tasty either. Good means useful. Okay? So they translated the word good to mean useful. Useful to you and useful to your children. How so? Tovim lecha, shal yideihem atam mekabel siman brachot. They're useful for you, because through them you will receive the blessing. Tovim lebanecha, good for your offspring. Sha'al yideihen mitkaper lehem b'yom ha-kippurim. Okay, good. I like the fact that you nodded your brow, right? That through them, they receive atonement on the Day of Atonement. Hahu dechtiv, and that's what it means when it says, ki vayom hazeh yichaper aleichem. On this day, you will be atoned. So somehow, we don't know how yet, the 2 goats that Rachel used and instigated Yaakov to deceive Yitzchak with foreshadow the 2 goats on Yom HaKippurim, which is the Seir Echad Lashem, the one goat that goes to God, and the other goat that goes to Azazel, that goes to the barren places where we throw the goat off the cliff. Okay, what do these 2 things have to do with each other? We have 2 goats in the story of Yaakov and Esav, and we have 2 goats on Yom HaKippurim, and the Midrash connects them. Okay? There's another Midrash which connects them again in a different way, but it's the same connection. There's a play on words. It says, source number 5, V'nasa ha-se'ir alav. The whole pasuk is, V'nasa ha-se'ir alav et avonotam el eretz gzeira. The se'ir, the goat, takes upon itself all their iniquities to the barren place. Okay? But the Midrash plays the following word game. V'nasa ha-se'ir alav ze Esav. The se'ir of Yom HaKippurim is Esav. Shene'emar, hein achi Esav, hein Esav achi, ish se'ir. Pasuk says that Esav was hairy. He was se'ir. So there's a word game, hairy and a goat is the same word. See, Esav is an ish se'ir. So he's the se'ir la'azazel. He is the scapegoat. Et kol avonotam, listen to this, this is great. When you break a word apart, avonotam is 2 words. Avonot, Tam. Who is the Ish Tam? Yaakov Ish Tam Yoshev Ohalim. He's the, I don't know, the pure one, the naive one, however you want to translate Tam. The complete one, doesn't matter now. Avonotam, so the Nasaha Seir et Avonot Tam. El Eretz Gzeira. The Avonot of the Tam are in the Rosh of the Seir. The sins of the Tam, of Yaakov, are on the head of Esav. That's the 2 se'irim. So what's going on here? Why are these 2 se'irim connected with Yaakov and Esav? Okay. So we have, anybody want to venture? A guess? No? No thoughts yet? Okay. So this is where we come to what I said before, that rituals tell a story. Let me give you an example of how a ritual will tell a story. This is pretty straightforward. Going to the mikveh and emerging from the mikveh tell the story of birth. When people emerge out of the water, the Talmud says that when somebody converts, they're like a newborn child, a newborn baby. So they emerge from the water. The world, and that in turn is that birthing image is what we have in the story of Bereishit. The waters recede, and v'teira'e ha'yabasha, and the dry land emerges from the receding waters. I think Joel Hecker, who talked here 3 lectures ago, he just touched upon it, about how Kriyat Yamsuf, I don't know who was here for that, how the splitting of the sea is a birthing image, Right? But it's a very powerful birthing image. Right? What do you have? Before the splitting of the sea, you have the blood on the passageway of the Korban Pesach, and then you have the splitting of the sea. So the blood on a passageway and the waters breaking, you don't have to have too much imagination what the imagery that the Torah is invoking. Okay? But so the ritual tells a story. So what story does the ritual of the two Se'irim tell? Of the two Se'irim on Yom HaKippurim, the two goats tell a story. So now let's go back and have the following portrait. We have a blind father. And the blind father has to choose between twins who are identical. And the Mishnah in Masechet Yoma goes out of its way to say how the two goats on Yom Kippur have to be identical. Okay? And he does not choose himself. He doesn't choose. In a sense, the deception occurs, and he only agrees afterwards. He lets God choose, because for whatever reason, he cannot choose himself. Because Yitzchak is of the personality that he can't really deviate from the law. And the law is that the older one needs to get the bracha, that the older one needs to get the blessing because he's the older one. So he can do nothing but give the blessing to the older one. But the older one can't get the blessing. So he, in a sense, even though he must be suspicious that the younger one is really the one standing before him, he touches him, he smells him, he says his voice sounds this way. He knows. He knows, but he doesn't know. He chooses not to know. And then when they tell him that it is, so he's, on the one hand, he, vayecharad Yitzchak charada gdola ad ma'od. It's, he shakes out of this revelation. And on the second hand, he immediately says, gam baruch yiyeh. Yes, the bracha should go to him. So he lets it happen, and there's a sort of a cognitive dissonance that's going on. How would I recreate that moment with a ritual? How would I do that? So I might take two goats, which are identical, since Esav is an East Seir. And the Kohen Gadol doesn't choose. The high priest does not choose which one goes as Lahashem, to God, into the Mikdash, and which one gets thrown over the cliff in Eretz Gzeirah in the barren lands. But there's a lot, which is the central activity on Yom Kippur, one of the central activities, which the lot decides. When the lot decides, that means God decides. And this is very central to Yom Kippur. Again, parenthetically, why do we read Yonah on Yom Kippur? Why do we read the book of Yonah on Yom Kippur? Somebody tell me? Right, because they had a lottery. And what did they do? The person that, right, everybody says, you're a step ahead of most people. I mean, everybody says, because it teaches us about tshuva. Right? And that's true. The people of Nineveh, Yechozeb, tshuva. But you're saying something more than that. What do they, when they have a problem, they cast lots. Right? And the lot falls on Yonah, and they throw him out. Right? That is, Yonah is the Seir La'azazel. And that's why, that's, in addition to the reason of tshuva, that's why we tell the story of Yonah on Yom HaKippurim. So we want to recreate this. So we have a Kohen Gadol. Now remember, Yitzchak never leaves the land of Israel. Yitzchak is a foreshadowing of the Kohen Gadol. He goes on to the Mizbeach for the Akedah. He goes on to the altar. And in a certain sense, he never leaves, even though physically he leaves. But he never really leaves. He never leaves the land of Israel. And he's blinded later as a consequence of the famous midrash that he was blinded by the tears of the angels when he was lying on the altar. You're familiar with this midrash? The midrash says, where did the blindness come from? Because at the altar, he saw the heavens open up and the angels were crying, and the crying blinded him. So that he never really got over the experience of being bound to the altar. In that sense, he's a Kohen Gadol. He's a Kohen Gadol. Figuratively speaking, it says, "Umina mikdash lo yetzei." The Kohen Gadol never leaves the area of the temple. Figuratively, he does at times, but he never really does. Because wherever he goes, they have the sanctity of the temple with him. And Yitzchak never left Eretz Yisrael. So Yitzchak and the Kohen Gadol stands in for Yitzchak. So I have to choose these two goats, and the Kohen Gadol is Yitzchak. He's reliving Yitzchak. And the two goats are Yaakov and Esav, and he's not going to choose, but rather God is going to choose. Okay? So there's a parallel between the portrait of a blind father with the two sons and the Kohen Gadol on Yom HaKippurim. So, but then we, the next question we have to ask is, but why do we do this on Yom HaKippurim? Okay, so I've shown you some parallels, but you have to do so. The parallels have to have some sort of meaning. So why do we do it? So here you have to look at when did the first Yom HaKippurim happen? When did it happen? In the desert. What happened right before that? Chet HaEgel, right? There's the Yom HaKippurim, you know, we can do the math, right? The Ma'amad Har Sinai, the Aseret HaDibrot, is either on Vav Sivan or Zayin Sivan. 40 days later, so when Moshe Rabbeinu went up and he didn't come down on time and the Luchot were broken, was Shivasa B'Tamuz, the fast day for the breaking of the Luchot. And then he went up for another 40 days. God said, come back up. And those 40 days he prayed to God that God should forgive them. And he came down, when was that? 40 days after Shivasa B'Tamuz is Rosh Chodesh Elul. And that's when Hashem said to him, Salachti Kidvarecha. And that's why Eidot HaMizrach starts saying Slichot on Rosh Chodesh Elul, because that's when Moshe Rabbeinu said, Hashem, Hashem, Kel Rachum B'Chanun. Because that ritual that they have of saying Slichot from Rosh Chodesh Elul reenact the story of Moshe Rabbeinu in the desert saying Slichot for 40 days from Rosh Chodesh Elul. And he went up for another 40 days. And from 40 days from Rosh Chodesh Elul is Yom HaKippurim. And he came down on Yom HaKippurim with the second Luchot. So the Yom HaKippurim is the time of the atonement for Chet HaEgel. Okay, that's the first Yom HaKippurim. Now, why do we have to reenact this aspect, this ritual of the story of Yaakov and Esav and Yitzchak on Yom HaKippurim? What happens after Chet HaEgel? After Chet HaEgel, there needs to be a new covenant. Because the old covenant that happened on Shavuot is no longer binding. Because any covenant, any agreement that you enter into, means that you have your responsibilities and your rights, and I have my responsibilities and my rights. And if there's a fatal violation, right, like in software when they first came out, you know, fatal flaw, like I hid under the table, I didn't know what it meant. So there's a fatal flaw in the agreement when the people transgress and they worship the golden calf. So that makes the previous agreement null and void, and that's why the Torah says, Ma'amad Har Sinai. Right, Atem Tiyuli Mamlechet Kohanim V'Goy Kadosh Ve'iti Lachem Le'Elohim. You'll be pure for me, and I'll be your God. That's the content of the covenant. But that covenant has been transgressed. And therefore, there's a need for a new covenant. This is actually the Christian narrative. Right? The Christian narrative of the destruction of the Second Temple is the Jews transgress the covenant, and there's a New Testament, right, which supersedes, right, these are super secessionists, most of traditional Christianity is super secessionist, that there's a new covenant through Christianity with the church, which supersedes the old covenant. But this idea of a new covenant is in the Torah, because on Yom HaKippurim, it says in the Torah, in Parshat Ki Tisa, in the Parsha of Chet HaEgel, afterwards it says, Hine Anochi Koreit Brit. Right now I'm cutting a new covenant. That's what it says in the Torah. So what is the content of this new covenant? If the people were originally chosen, and now through the sin of the golden calf they have become unchosen, so we have to re-choose them. So we have to reenact the chosenness of the Jewish people in the central ritual of Yom HaKippurim. How do we do that? And what story do we go back to? We go back to the story of Yaakov and Esav, and how Yaakov got chosen and Esav got rejected. So we're reaffirming the chosenness of the Jewish people after Chet HaEgel, and that's why it's necessary to reenact that ritual. Right? So the ritual, right, but we have to reenact the chosenness. No, but there's a new covenant. The new covenant is not the same as the old covenant. It's a new covenant. It doesn't have the same terms. It has terms where people can sin and still be part of the covenant. The first covenant doesn't allow for that. But that's a longer, it's a longer discussion, which we can't get into now. But what needs to be reenacted is the chosenness of the Jew, of the Jewish people. And for that, we go back to the story of Yaakov and Esav. Okay? Now, so that's one level of the story. Okay? That's how the ritual tells a story. Okay? Now, let's take it a little deeper, okay, and talk about what the tension between Yaakov and Yitzchak might symbolize. Okay? And here I would like to draw your attention to something in the source number 7. This is again from the book, the Mehashiloach. What? Yeah. So it says, he noticed, Rav Mordechai Yosef Ishbitz, noticed a very interesting parallel or contrast between Yaakov and Esav. Yaakov and Yitzchak. Yitzchak must give the brachot to Esav. He, in a sense, has no choice, and he has to be deceived and manipulated in order that the bracha should go to Yaakov. Yaakov himself, in a similar situation, where he has Ephraim and Menashe standing before him, there he has no problem. He just switches his hands around. Right? So you have a similar situation with Yitzchak and his sons, and Yaakov and his grandchildren, who are like his sons, but Yitzchak is paralyzed, and Yaakov has no problem. So what does this mean? Okay. So he says as follows: Sikelet Yadav, source number 7. Lihiyot ki Yitzchak Avinu hayam madregato midat gvura. Okay, now I need to explain this. He's using a Kabbalistic typology, where he's saying that Yitzchak is gvura. V'lachein, let me read a little bit and I'll explain it. V'lachein ratza levarech et Esav. And therefore he wanted to give the blessing to Esav. Ki midat ha-gvura more al divrei Torah. Because gvura has to do with law. Kach, and he gives an example. Kach shama Moshe mipi ha-gvura. The lawgiver is described in the, by Chazal as the gvura. He heard from the, it would be translated probably as the Almighty. But there's a very specific term here. There's gvura, right? Mipi ha-gvura. Now, what does he mean by this? And this I want to digress a little bit, but it's very, very important to understand. When I say, for example, and maybe you've heard it, that Avraham is chesed, and Yitzchak is gvura, and Yaakov is tiferet, and Moshe is netzach, and Aaron is hod, and Yosef is Yisod. Right? The only thing that we understand is that when we say David HaMelech is Malchus, I understand. Right? David HaMelech is monarchy, kingship, I understand. Right?
Yes. Sorry to interrupt.
Yeah.
Could you explain all that in English?
Yes, sure. Okay. So, fine. Thank you. There are certain attributes, okay, which are embodied in people. So we talk about loving kindness, right, the chesed, we say Avraham somehow represents loving kindness. And Yitzchak somehow represents judgment. Right. Let's just stop there, but that's sufficient, right? But that's what we're dealing with here. So what does that mean? That you're very careful not to fall into cliches when we say, you know, Avraham represents chesed, represents loving kindness. What does that mean? Okay. So for this, I think, let's look at it this way. In the Kabbalistic view, God has a personality. And God, unlike the Rambam, has a complex personality, like anyone else. Because there's part of the personality that wants to give and create and wants to love. And there's another part of that personality that says, if I love everyone and if I give unconditionally, I won't get recognition and it's not personal and ultimately that love will go to waste. So I have to limit that love and to bring it out to someone who is deserving of it. And if someone is not deserving of the love, they're not going to get the love. That is chesed, loving kindness, as opposed to justice. Let me try and explain it from a slightly different angle. Okay, and for this, I want to go to source number one. Okay? Here, this is also from the book Me'a Shiloach, from the Ishbitzer Rebbe. Yes. Okay. So it says, Tishma Chalom Liftoroto. This is Paro talking to Yosef, saying, you can understand a dream and interpret it. Okay? To which the Me'a Shiloach says, Hainu ki kol inyanei olam hazeh, all things of this world, heim ki chalom, they're all like a dream. This goes to what we talked about reality before. Heim ki chalom hatzarich pitarom. They're like a dream. This whole world is like a dream which requires interpretation. Ukemoshi yiftar lo ha'adam, and as it is interpreted, ken yakum etzlo. And that's what will happen. Okay. So he says that the world that we live in is like a dream that requires interpretation. Aside from maybe sounding a little poetic, like what does that mean? So in order to justify dream interpretation, you have to assume, first of all, that dreams have meaning. They didn't always assume that. Right? Oh, it's just a dream. It doesn't mean anything. But certainly after Freud, we know that dreams are projections of the subconscious into an altered state of consciousness when the ego is asleep. So there's, Freud has this economics of the personality. So when you're awake, so there's energy keeping the libido down, but when that energy gets lifted, so then all sorts of things come to the surface. But your consciousness is still working because they can't come to the surface explicitly because they're too threatening, so they come out as symbols. And then through interpretation, you can understand what the dream is saying. So there's the latent, the manifest dream, what he calls, which is the story, which is the pshat, right? The storyline of the dream. Oh, I had a dream about this, I had a dream about that. And then there's the latent meaning of the dream, which is the inner meaning of what you get from when you interpret the dream, okay? Now, the question is, when he says the world, now he lived before Freud, but it doesn't matter because he's talking about similar things. Whose dream is it that the world is? Anybody want to venture? He says the world is a dream that needs interpretation. It's God's dream, right? And the assumption is it has to be. Because that if the world has no meaning, so then you cannot interpret it. It's a futile, if it's just a dream and it doesn't, if it's a 3-year-old scribbling on the floor with a crayon that you just have to clean up afterwards, you're not going to sit and say, oh, this is wonderful modern art. He was just scribbling on the floor. It doesn't have any meaning. But if you say that it's God's dream is the world, you're assuming that first that the world has meaning so that the activity of interpretation is meaningful. Now, by way of just a way of talking about this, so if the world is God's dream, that means that in a sense, the world is a projection of God's consciousness. There's something going on, so to speak, in God's mind that produces the world. And we then, in a sense, are commissioned to put God on the couch and say, okay, what does this dream mean? Like, what does this mean? So in God's dream, he had a dream about someone named Avraham, who he told to leave his homeland, and Avraham went, and he wandered, and he followed him, and he was willing to do all these things for him. And then he had another dream about Yitzchak, etc., etc. Now, we know that when you have a dream about someone, it doesn't tell you anything about the person you dreamed about. It's a projection of you. There's only you in the dream. So then God says to you, in a sense, what does this dream mean? So I'll tell you what this means. It means you have unconditional love for the world. And Avraham Avinu, Avraham embodies that. And he's acting that out in your dream. And Yitzchak acts out something else, acts out the necessity you understand that there has to be restraint. In order for the love to come out, you have to be able to restrain yourself and not give it freely. And you're conflicted about that. So you have this story about Avram and Yitzchak and Avram sacrificing Yitzchak and not having to sacrifice. That's all an interpretation. In a sense, what we have to do is interpret it, because that's God's dream. The Torah is God's dream, and we're God's dream. And that's why we can interpret it. Okay? So when you say Avram is chesed, what you mean is, when you say Avram is loving kindness, you mean that there's an attribute that God has, which is that he loves the world and creation unconditionally. And that is symbolized by the life and deeds of Avram Avinu. And so too, when you talk about Yitzchak, Yitzchak is embodies the understanding that you have to limit that love. We'll give you an example. There are Nazi war criminals who still are alive and walk the face of the earth. And they breathe the same air that we breathe. And that should be religiously and humanly profoundly disturbing, is that we share the same planet with people like that. The only reason they breathe is because of chesed. But where's the justice? So we demand justice. So we demand that God take the air away from them and only give it to people who deserve to breathe.
Well, since you mentioned that, yeah. I have a question at
yeah.
this point.
Yeah.
Just thinking of that. Since this is in Toronto, we have Holocaust Education Week. Today's the first day of it, actually, official day. And if the world is God's dream, then human suffering is an illusion, and the Holocaust is also an illusion.
No. Because by virtue of the fact, this is a longer discussion, by virtue of the fact that it is God's dream and not your dream, okay, that makes it real, just as God's speech makes things real.
But then you're saying...
I'm not diminishing the suffering at all. Both my parents are Holocaust survivors. Believe me, I wouldn't think of diminishing the suffering. It's a different take on what produces reality. It's very real. I can send you to an article I wrote about it, but it's very real.
Okay.
But I accept the concern that you have for this. Okay. Yes, we wouldn't want to diminish the reality of evil. There is the dream is real, and it creates things as real as they can be, because it's God's dream.
Yeah.
Well, the metaphor breaks down at some point. When Shakespeare, Lahavdil, when Shakespeare writes... Excuse me? Okay. That's okay. The question was that what is produced by God's dream is different than what's produced by my dream. Of course, it's a way of talking about it. So just like I'm not God, right? So obviously the comparison breaks down at some point. Okay. So that's what the Me'ah Shiloach here is alluding to give justification to interpretation of the world. We don't just interpret the Torah, we interpret the world. For instance, Rabbi Tzadok HaKohen Milublin says that just like in the Torah there's four levels of interpretation, there's pshat and drash and remez and so, there's the straightforward meaning, and there's how you derive things, and then there are things that are alluded to, and then there's the hidden meanings. He said, just like we have that in interpretation of the Torah, you have that in interpretation of the world. Right? There's what's the pshat of what happened here, what's the straightforward meaning of what happened here, and what's the inner meaning of what happened here. Or when I talk to someone, there's the pshat of what I said, and then there might be the subtext of what I said. Right? So there are things being expressed in different ways, in different places, by God and by us, and they're parallel. Okay, parallel does not mean the exact same. I accept what you're saying, of course. Yes. Okay, so let's get back to this. This is all necessary to understand his point about Yitzchak Avinu Hayam Madrigato Madrigat Gvura. Yitzchak is divine judgment. Okay, now. Yitzchak is blind, and he must adhere, according to his typology, he must adhere to the law. He has no choice. He represents that. Avram represents love and go for it, and Yitzchak is very, very narrow in his concerns, and in a sense, he just wants to make sure to get things right, which is why he never does anything. He does very, very little, and whatever he does, he basically repeats what Avram did. It says, "Vayachpor taborot asher chafar Avraham aviv." He redug the wells that his father Abraham dug. that's symbolic of his, of the way he acted in the world. We have people, sometimes you have people who are effusive and they're willing to go for it and take a chance. And then you have people who they just want to get it right. And they're afraid, and this comes from Yirat Shamayim, from fear of heaven. They're afraid to get it wrong, so they do very little. They do just what it says, in a sense, in the Mishnah Berurah. And they don't want to think about anything else. They're afraid of thinking about anything else. Okay? So that is what Yitzchak is. So Yitzchak has to go according to the law. What is law? How would we define? Do we have any lawyers here? No lawyers? No, these are lawyers. Okay, I'll give you a definition for law. Law is the indiscriminate application of principles, of abstract principles in a specific instance. Okay? In other words, the law is not allowed to discriminate between people. That's the basis of law. You have a rule. The rule is not made for this person or that person. It's an abstract principle. But I have to apply it in a specific case. But I'm not allowed to take into account the individual standing before me. I just have to apply the law to the case. It's very not personal. There's a story about one of the Gdolei Yisrael when he adjudicated a Din Torah, when a Torah case came before him and there were two people arguing, he would cover his head with his talis, and so he wouldn't look at them when he spoke to them, because he didn't want to be influenced by the people, because the law is this Platonic truth that has to be applied, and you cannot discriminate. That's why the Torah, in its instructions to the judges, repeatedly says things like "Lo taguru mipnei ish," be fearful of no man, or "Dal lo tehdar berivo," you should not favor a poor person in a court of law, because you're not allowed to look at the person. Justice is blind. Yitzchak is blind, because Yitzchak is justice, right? And so it goes before the Greek goddess of justice, who is blind. Right? Yitzchak is also blind. He is not allowed, in a sense, to look at the individuals before him. He just must apply the law. Now, this is insufficient for life. Because that's why every legal system has a way around, has the Mapainik way, right? Has a way around it, right? Which we call clemency or pardon, where there are certain things that should be taken into account, but the judge is not allowed to take into account. So the president, the prime minister, the governor, somebody has to be empowered to say, this might be the law, but it's not fair. Right? There's justice and there's equity. It might be the law, but it's not fair. Okay, suppose you have someone who was a war hero. He saved the country. He stopped a row of tanks in the Golan single-handedly 40 years ago. And now we just caught him cheating on his income taxes. The law says history is history, but the fact is he cheated on his income taxes and we're going to throw him into jail. That's true. That is the law. But you know what? It's not fair. There has to be some sort of mechanism to recognize the broader picture and to say there has to be some sort of recognition of this person's service to the country. And okay, so he fell. So we have to deal with that. But we're not going to treat him like some underworld figure who was convicted of money laundering. Even though it might be in the books, it's the same law. Right? But we have to treat it differently. That is not din. That is called rachamim. That is mercy. Mercy is not throwing away the law, but seeing the broader picture. We talk about din, hold on. We talk about din emet, right? A true judgment. And then there's this phrase, emet la'amito. Truth of the truth. What is emet la'amito? Is when you actually take the broader perspective. And that's rachamim. And Yaakov is a symbol for that. Okay, yes. Yeah, so there are midrashim that say that their tshuva was not complete, and that later they went back to their evil ways. But God, there's like a broader perspective. Look, Yonah, we'll talk about Yonah for a second, his father is Yonah ben Amittai. Amittai is Emet, he's the son of truth. And he can't handle God's forgiveness. Well, they should be punished. And that's Yonah's claim against God. And when he says the Yudgimu Midot HaRachamim, this is really a drasha for Yom Kippur, but when he says Yudgimu Midot HaRachamim, he changes them. He uses it as an accusation against God. He says, Ki Yadati, Ki El Rachum V'Chanun Erech Apayim V'Rav Chesed. I knew you would forgive them. Damn it. Right? I knew it. Right? The Rav Chesed. And then he doesn't say, what does it say after that in the Torah? V'Rav Chesed, and great kindness, and Emet. But that's, look and say for Yonah. It doesn't say Emet. It says Rav Chesed u'menachem al ra'ah. You're overbounding with loving kindness, and you forgive evil. Ah, right. That was Yonah. Right? Yonah said it's not Emet. His cry out to God was, "This is not Emet," and that's the lesson that Yonah has to learn. Okay. So you're right. And that's rachamim, and that's why we do that on Yom Kippur. Okay. And we're going to come back to that. He says, God, no, God's Emet is lacking. Because they were evil and they deserve to be punished. They were evil, they deserve to be punished. Don't forgive them. That's right. And God didn't like it either, and that's why the Akedah happened after that. But that's a different story. Okay? But let's stick to this. Okay? We can't do all of Sefer Bereshit and all of Sefer Yonah, right? We have 10 minutes. So. Okay. So he says as follows: Yitzchak Avinu haya madrigato madrigat gvura. Yitzchak's personality characteristic embodied God's might, which is the adherence to law under all circumstances. V'lachein ratzal v'arechet esav. So if I ask you, according to the law, who should get the bracha? Who should get the blessing according to the law? Esav, because he's the oldest one. But who should really get the blessing? Yaakov. Right? Okay. Ki midat ha-gvura more al divrei Torah. Because the attribute of gvura and might alludes to the law, to divrei Torah as the law. Kach shaman gives that example, right? V'lachein amar yikov adin et achar. And that's why Yitzchak said that the law must even cut through the mountain. V'lachein lo haya b'kocho lasot neged ha-mishpat. And therefore he didn't have it within his power to go against the law, because he embodies the law. V'ratzal avarechet Esav, and he wanted to bless Esav, b'yan ki haya b'chor, because he was the firstborn. Ach ki Hashem yitbarach, but God didn't let it happen. Okay? But rather, he gave it to Yaakov. Aval Yaakov, I'm skipping a little bit, Avinu, haya mistakel tamid el habina v'liritzon Hashem. Yaakov's attribute is rachamim. Rachamim is looking at the broader perspective. It's looking at what is the real desire of God. Because there's an assumption here, which is very important, is that there is a dissonance between law, halacha, and the will of God. The standard, you could say, Litvisha theology, is that the will of God is the halacha. So what he's saying here is no. When you don't know the will of God, you have the halacha as an estimation. You have general principles which guide you when you don't know the will of God. But Yaakov Avinu was able to divine the will of God beyond the law. And that is rachamim. Just like we can sense, I talk about the tax evasion case, we can sense intuitively, very deeply, the injustice, well, not the injustice, the inequity of putting a war hero in jail and treating him the same way you treat Don Corleone. There's something just not right about it. But it can't be defined in the law. There's something beyond the law. That's what rachamim is, and that's what Yaakov embodies. So we have a conflict between the law and the will of God, or between the narrow view of application of what we think is true to a deeper truth. Now, okay, so let's take that to a Rashi in Sefer Bereshit. says, Bereshit bara Elokim. This is the third Rashi in Sefer Bereshit, source number 6. Okay? Bara Elokim, v'lo amar bara Hashem. Doesn't say the four letter, doesn't say Havaya created the world. It says Elokim created the world. Shebatchila, I'll explain what Hashem and Elokim mean, but the Rashi itself will explain. Rashi himself will explain it. Shebatchila ala b'machshava livroto b'midat hadin, ra'a she'en olam mitkayem, hikdim midat rachamim v'shitfo l'midat hadin. So the original intent, and this is very strange, right? The original intent of God was to create the world with justice. But he saw that the world would never survive that way, so he mixed it with mercy. And that's what it means when it says at the end, Hainu Dichtiv, in the second chapter of Bereshit, Biyom Asot Hashem Elokim Eretz V'Shamayim. The name Hashem, Yud Kei Vav Kei, indicates Rachamim. Let's just accept that. Okay? The name Elohim indicates Din. In Sefer Shemot, the word Elohim is used to describe judges. Ad ha-Elohim yavo dvar shneihem. Elohim is power, all the might, and the authority. But that is not who God is really. It's sort of a mask that God puts on. Right? God is really Rachamim, but He puts on a mask the way, like when we get angry at our children, or when we're never really supposed to get angry at our children, but we're supposed to sometimes make them think that we're angry at them when they do things. So we put on a mask. Right? I'm talking about this ideal parent, right? I never got angry at my children. Right? So but we put on a mask that we make believe we're angry, right? And then we have to hold ourselves back from sometimes laughing so they don't see. But like they did something stupid, and they have to know that we're angry even though we're not. So that's the mask. That's the mask of Elohim. Okay? So God, there's an original intent to create the world b'midat hadin. What does that mean? Okay. What does that mean, to create the world b'midat hadin? Yes. But why do we say that the original intent is to create a world b'midat hadin? Because midat hadin is the way things are supposed to be. Well, we all have this part. Some people are more like this. Some people are less like this. They're stuck on what's supposed to be. Right? They're midat hadin people. It's supposed to be this way. And when God, just think about the creative process, and let's anthropomorphize it a little bit. When God came to create the world, the way we create is we have a picture in our minds that we then translate through a process of contemplation, and then how do we feel about it until we do something. It gets translated into reality. The original concept, when you finally create it, it's never exactly what you thought. It's always different. So what was God's original conception of the world? It could be nothing but a perfect world. That's what He conceived, right? It could be nothing but a perfect world. But that doesn't work. The perfectionism, the world will continue to be a disappointment. So that's why you have like these midrashim that say God created worlds and destroyed them. Created worlds and He destroyed them. Until He said, okay, this is the one I'll keep. So what is that talking about? Whenever what's the greatest enemy to creativity? Perfectionism. You write the poem, it's no good. You crumple it up and you throw it in the waste basket. You paint the painting and it's not what I thought, and you destroy it. And you leave no writings after you die, right? Because nothing was good enough. Right? So the greatest enemy of creativity is perfectionism. Right? There was this book about creative writing. It talked about writing with two sides of the brain. I don't know if you ever saw the book. It's a very good book. Personally, it helped me out. Because it says that one side of your brain is the writer, and the other side of the brain is your editor. And don't mix them up. Right? Yeah, when you want to write, just write. Don't edit. Just get it out. Afterwards, you can turn the other side of your brain towards it and edit it. But if you edit while you write, you'll just get a messed up piece of paper. Right? So that is God's predicament. God's predicament is He had in mind to create a perfect world, but He kept on throwing it out into the garbage pail. That's Hashem borel lamot umachrivan. Created worlds and He destroyed them. Until He saw that it's impossible otherwise. So God, nothing changed in the world. God, so to speak, came to a realization that the powers of creation, even though they are imperfect, But if you want to look at the broader picture and you want creation, you have to let it be. You have to let it happen. Anyway, so the struggle, so what is this talking about? This is talking about a struggle that God has, so to speak. Now we'll put God on the couch again. And we say, you had a dream about two brothers and a father wanting to give a blessing to one of them, and the blessing had to go to the other one. So again, say, what does this mean? He'll say, I'll tell you what this means. You have a real conflict in creation. One side of you wants to create. You just want to go for it, and you want to create. But the other side of you won't let you create because it won't be perfect. And God, you're a perfectionist, so you got to get past it. This is where I'm going to take $500 an hour from God, because there's this struggle that's going on. That is b'kei shakadosh hu levruat haolam b'midat hadin ra'ashe no mitkayim shitefim o'midat harachamim. He wanted to create with judgment, but it can't work. So he mixed mercy into the judgment. The greater perspective is that the world needs to be created anyway. Okay. Now, this story, when was the world created? Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur. Now we have a story of the two Se'irim. Go back. There's a ritual here of the two goats, which reenact the story. What's the story that they're reenacting? It's reenacting the chosenness of Yaakov and the rejection of Esav, because that's what has to happen on Yom Kippur after the first covenant was fatally flawed, right? But that, it doesn't stop there. The story of Yaakov and Esav, let's use what we talked about before, is a dream in the mind of God. In other words, that is a projection of something else that was going on. That story is a projection of the conflict, so to speak, that was going on inside God's consciousness of to create or not to create. And that is what's getting acted out in the story of Yaakov and Esav. So what we see from here, first of all, is that the chosenness of the Jewish people is connected to the creation of the world, which goes back to simple Midrashei Chazal that said, Bireshit, the world was created in the beginning, Reshit, Bishvil Yisrael, Shinikru Reshit, the world was created for Israel. But now it has much deeper meaning, because the story of the chosenness of Israel is in fact a reenactment. That story is telling another story. The stories tell stories. That story, being a dream and being interpreted, tell the story about the consciousness of God, so to speak, where now it goes back to the conflict in creation itself. So the struggle between Yaakov and Yitzchak and Esav is the struggle that's happening within God. Do you create or do you not create? So Yitzchak, by not willing to give the bracha to Yaakov, is basically saying, can't create. Because if the bracha doesn't go to Yaakov, there isn't going to be a world from our perspective. So, but then Midat HaRachamim comes in, and we bring Midat HaRachamim Yaakov, and the world gets created anyway, but only because Din lets go. Only because Din realizes that he can't do it. So Yitzchak, being blind and not being able to act beyond what the law is, but he does let it happen. And that's where Yitzchak undergoes the crucial development, which is necessary, which is that's the realization of Ra'ash Eino Mitkayem. Right, he saw that the world couldn't exist without it. And that's when the bracha goes to Yaakov. So when does this whole story get reenacted? What's getting reenacted on Yom Kippur? What's getting reenacted on Yom Kippur is creation, which is that's the time of the year. Right? Because what does Yom Kippur say? On Rosh Hashanah is Yom Hadin. That is the day that commemorates not creation, the original concept of creation. It doesn't say Hayom Briat Olam. What does it say in the davening? Hayom Harat Olam. Today is the conception of the world, not the creation of the world. It's the original conception of Midat Hadin. And that's why Rosh Hashanah is called Midat Hadin, Yom Hadin, the Day of Judgment. Because that is Rosh Hashanah never happened. That was just the original idea that God had. What happened was Yom HaKippurim. What happened was that the din was enveloped in rachamim in order that the world should exist, which is why Rosh Hashanah we call Yom HaZikaron and Yom HaDin, but Yom Kippur is Yom HaRachamim, right, is the day of mercy. That dance between Yaakov and Yitzchak is the story of creation, which gets reenacted on Rosh Hashanah and on Yom Kippurim. So that's how the story of those holidays, the rituals of those holidays, tell us a story of Yaakov and Esav, and they, which go back and they tell us the story of creation, because that's what's happening now again. Okay? All right. Thank you. Okay. I have a plate to catch. I'm sorry. But my email address is on here. If you have any questions, I'll be happy to relate to them. Thank you.